Welcome to Cross-Examining Cyber, a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. We explore all things cyber, including the legal, regulatory, and policy developments that impact corporate Australia. I'm Cam Whitfield, a partner at Herbert Smith Freehills and the leader of our Asia-Pac cyber practice. In this series, we'll look at the evolving cyber risk landscape in Australia by speaking to those people who are shaping the Australian legal and regulatory landscape. Those who are on the front line of protecting Australian companies from cyber incidents. In our previous podcast, we spoke with Hamish Hansford. Hamish is Deputy Secretary of Cyber and Infrastructure Security within Home Affairs. And at the time of recording, he was the Acting National Cybersecurity Coordinator. In part one of our discussion, we talked about a range of topics, including the cybersecurity strategy, proposed reporting regimes, limited use rights and no-fault, no-liability proposals. In this episode, we continue the discussion with Hamish. We take a closer look at the SOCI Act, law enforcement success, and I also ask him for some guidance on what a good lawyer looks like in this space. A risky question, but I decided to go there anyway. Thanks again for joining us, and now back to my discussion with Hamish.
Now I'm going to move from the strategy, one of your key areas and your baby, the Security of Critical Infrastructure Act. Can I first clear up one thing? The acronym. I've heard SOCI, I've heard SOCI, I've heard many variations of it. What is it?
I call it SOCI, but
SOCI.
You know, yeah. I don't think I've
got the name right. SOCI. All right. Well, look, we'll help you sort of spread the good word around SOCI. There you go. Just for those who have been really living under a rock in the last few years, in broad terms, can you explain how that piece of legislation works, why it was so important to create legislation that sought to protect our critical infrastructure at this particular point in time?
Sure. I think for the last 30, 40 years, we've had a society that's grown up and become much more networked and interconnected. So the decision by the government and the parliament in 2018 to say, we should define critical infrastructure, I think really recognises that fact, that any one individual infrastructure operator can have an impact on others. Mm. And so that's really the driving concept. And that the Act itself really just does four things. The first is define infrastructure. And I think that that's really important because if you don't define what you're protecting, it's harder to protect it. The second thing it does is set up some preventative obligations. The risk management program is probably the key one. Mm-hmm. Say, here's the baseline for security settings for critical infrastructure. Here's what we think should be the base. It's certainly not something to aim for, but actually just the base. Then cyber incident reporting, understanding the true impact of incidents on critical infrastructure and us building a register of who owns and operates infrastructure and where it is. That's the preventative bit. Then we've got a systems of national significance, which are a subset of critical infrastructure, that we took the view that actually there should be added cyber protections, particularly to bounce back and respond to a cyber incident. So that's what that whole regime is all about. How do you respond to a cyber incident? Then if it all goes wrong, we've got responsive mechanisms in there, which are effectively what we call government assistance measures. That if there's a cyber incident impacting the economy, that we don't have any other tool that would assist, these give information gathering powers, directions, and ultimately an intervention power to respond to the incident. So that's the package. And really what we're trying to do is define infrastructure and put powers in to both prevent and then respond.
That's a pretty good explanation. In the short space of time, we've had the Act in place for a while now. All key components are activated now, including the risk management program components. How successful do you think it's been today?
Well, I'm a bit biased, but I hear when I talk to people like yourself, yeah, security consultants, people working in industry, that the culture's changing, particularly around the risk management program. Yeah. People are thinking about risk. They're thinking about all hazards risk. They're engaging with their boards and CEOs. And I think that anecdotally, I'm hearing such a great response from industry in Australia, and I hear that time and time again. So I think it's having a major impact. And I hear people kind of proudly talk about the fact that they're a critical infrastructure asset and therefore they're important for the economy. I hear people in slightly smaller groups talk about them as systems of national significance, and then why they have an added responsibility to think about response planning and exercising and responding to cyber incidents. And I see that change culturally. And I see a strong engagement, particularly through our non-regulatory function, our Trusted Information Sharing Network. I see so many people actually collaborating and engaging. And I didn't see that when I came to the job back in 2021 for the centre job. And before that, we were designing the legislation.
It's interesting, actually. We had a survey that we put out to about 120 legal leaders in the middle of last year, asking them about various components of their cybersecurity resilience and response and the like. And we asked a question about whether or not regulation had a positive impact on driving uplift. And an overwhelming majority had said it did. But then the follow-up question is, what do we need anymore? And the overall response was, we don't need more. So there's the balance, I guess, because, and this is a nice segue into the next part of the discussion, and that is that under the strategy and under the legislative reform proposals, we're now looking at entities that are protecting data storage systems, systems that hold business critical data. Why wasn't that covered originally? And explain to us why it's so important to have that part of our sort of sector, if you like, or that sector pulled into the SOC Act.
Sure. Yeah. So I think the 21 and 22 reforms covered the commercial provision of data storage and processing.
Mm-hmm.
So people who provide data centers or cloud infrastructure on a commercial basis. What we looked at then is some critical infrastructure entities actually have connectivity between their IT and their operational technology. Great example is Colonial Pipeline in the US, where effectively a cyber attack on ICT infrastructure, where they then closed down the pipeline. So what this reform and consultation at the moment is saying is, if you have those two things connected, you need to protect them to the same level. And so, first of all, we want to define them as critical infrastructure. If there's a connectivity between things like business critical data, customer data sets, and the broader infrastructure asset, if you structurally segment them and they're effectively two operating entities, then that's okay. But what we're trying to do is make sure we're doing everything we can to protect the infrastructure asset. And so that's the basis of that reform.
Okay. Can I digress a little bit? You were fully immersed in the consultation process. I don't know how many hours you put during that consultation process before the reforms came through on SOCI, but I know you're not supposed to have a favourite child, but out of that full suite, which is a series of compromises, I get it, along the way, which part of that legislative suite do you look back and go, that was a really important and significant, but perhaps sort of underrated piece of legislation?
Well, in SOCI,
yeah,
I think you can't go past the risk management program. I really don't. I mean, $11 billion reform to 13 classes of critical infrastructure that effectively didn't have a holistic all hazards risk management plan. I think that has fundamentally changed the concept of security. And people often talk to me about SOCI just being a cyber act. It's not. It's a physical security act. It's a personnel security act. It's a supply chain security act and a cyber act. And I think that's been foundational. I think that the most difficult part of the legislation that we had, particularly I might add from some of our multinational friends, is Part 3A, which is all of the government assistance powers. Because when you read them in their entirety, they are actually quite significant powers.
Mm.
But then you've got to go back to the start of it and say, and what are the circumstances that those would be used in? And I've got to say, if we're using those powers, something has gone significantly wrong in the economy and we can't respond to it in the way that we would like. And so I think that balance really shows that we haven't used them, but they're there on the statute book in the event that we need to.
You make a good point. One is about both the options to do something. Then there is the actual act of doing something. And I know there's been a change in rhetoric recently around moving from, dare I say it, a sort of an information education sort of approach, making sure everyone has their sort of house in order to an enforcement or at least forward-looking enforcement approach. Not an unusual evolution for a piece of legislation as significant as this. What does that mean for the likes of the CISC and other sort of regulators in this space moving generally, because those words have been used in general terms, moving more towards an enforcement space? What can we expect to see?
Yeah, so we have an enforcement and compliance plan, which, as you said, for the first couple of years is very much focused on education, understanding, information sharing. What we're designing at the moment is a compliance and enforcement program of work to commence from 1 July of this year, given that's when our compliance and enforcement kind of funding really kicks in, to work out, well, are people comply with the obligation? And our very first focus is, what is the serious non-compliance? People who are not doing anything at all. And that might take the form of people who aren't reporting a cyber incident. Maybe they don't know about it, so that's an intervention. And the kind of enforcement end will be if you deliberately have non-compliance. But we're trying to change the culture over time. We're very lenient for those who are trying to do the right thing. And so that's kind of the focus that we'll have from 24 maybe to 26, really to build up that awareness and education into trying to make sure that people are thinking about it, complying with it, and only focusing on our powers where there's egregious non-compliance.
Thanks for that clarification. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how that sort of enforcement sort of flows out in the next few years. I understand that you've got to, sooner or later, the regulator or those regulating the space have to demonstrate some teeth in order for the regulations to become effective.
Well, I suppose a great example is if someone has a risk management program, it's not very good, but they're trying with all of the resources that they have to build a plan. I think that's a great thing versus someone who's like, oh, yeah, we don't really want to do that.
And can I ask, because we often get questions asked of us, which is, what does this plan look like? You know, is it a couple of pages? Is it, you know, do I have to go through all this mechanism? Am I supposed to hire people like you, Cam, to sort of bring it all together? I mean, how are you and or at least those in your areas of government and in that regulatory space, helping people understand what good looks like in that risk management program? Because those questions come thick and
Oh, great advice. So we've got a whole bunch of guidance on our website, but I think the reason why we haven't said here's what a plan should look like is the Critical Infrastructure Act across 11 sectors, 22 classes of critical infrastructure asset, all of the assets look very different. Mm-hmm. So if you're a hospital, you're much different from an electricity generation provider. And so that was kind of a principles-based approach. And the risk management plan should be commensurate with the material risks to your business. And so if you have very few of them, then the plan will obviously be shorter. Mm. But if the more complex you are, the longer the plan effectively will be. And so we opted for principles-based for that very reason. I think the kind of other point that we see all the time is people say, oh, we've got to do this really big plan and we've got to start again. Like, no, you don't. You will already have security settings in place. What it's trying to do is bring it all together in one place and give the board and the CEO a view about the risk to the entity, particularly premised around the concept of material risk. And so I've spoken to a hospital recently, for example, who said, we've got to do this risk management program and we've got to start again. They're like, well, do you have access control? Like, yeah, no, we've got that. Do you have an ICT security plan? Oh, no, we've got that. Have you got a plan for how do you do physical protections? Oh, yeah, we've got that. Well, we'll just bring it all together and think about material risks in that concept. And so they're starting to bring that together.
And interestingly, you gave an encouragement for those to voluntarily or at least report back to the regulator around their risk management program. Did you get much uptake on that voluntary component?
Yeah, we've got about 50 people who voluntarily went through the reporting. And I think that's now regularising for them the reporting to the board. So next year when they...
And did you feedback into those organisations to say this is an adequate form plan?
Yeah, we gave feedback about the response that they gave and I think we're still in the process of doing that. Mm. But this year when people have to do it for real, I think then they're like, we've already done it, we understand what it is, and those 50-odd companies are miles ahead of others who haven't.
Yeah, I can. Again, another 180 shift. We talk about defensive security. We talk about obligations on companies and corporates. and uplifting cyber resilience more generally. But there wouldn't be a corporate in the country that's asking the question, what are we doing on the offensive security part of this? When I say offensive, not just sort of active cybersecurity, you know, the hacking back style, but also law enforcement. And it's hard at times for us who aren't deep in the in those processes to know how effective they are. Now, we saw a takedown of the Black Hat sort of website. We saw Black Hat pop up with another one. We saw a takedown of that, which sort of pop up with another one. But my sense is that there is some positive developments in that offensive security side. When we speak to those that are dealing with things like extortion payments, those are at the very, very front line, the negotiators and the like, they said they're seeing a decline in extortion payments, and they believe a lot of it, or at least a component of it, is more effective law enforcement, for example. Can you just talk us through what are we seeing in that? To the extent you can, of course, some of the stuff is incredibly sensitive, but what we're seeing in that sort of offensive security that gives corporates comfort, but it's not just them defending government, the AFP, you know, what do we have, Quilla, Project Red Spice, like how are those programs running?
Well, I think Australia added our offensive capability in the 2016 cybersecurity strategy. In the 2021, we said we used that capability against some of those criminals trying to impact Australia. And in the 2023 one, there's more funding for Operation Aquila,
yep,
which gives you the sense that that capability is extremely useful and potent, and it's effectively trying to make Australia a much more hostile place for cyber criminals. And so I think what the government's signaling, particularly in this strategy, is that it's in the mix of different capabilities, and the reason why the government's investing more money in the federal police kind of gives you the sense about its success. Of course, Minister O'Neill and the Attorney General stood up and announced the Hackers Task Force,
yep,
and trying to bring life and focus to that particular mission, now linked through Operation Aquila. Lots of it, as you said, we can't really go into,
yes,
but it is an effective, a serious and significant contribution. And I think kind of gets to the point about the strategy. It's not one single thing. It's a whole mix of different capabilities, and that's definitely in the mix.
And what about this? Because I've always thought that one of the things that we're missing or have missed is adequate risk intelligence sharing and timely risk intelligence sharing, particularly amongst corporates. We were discussing this with various governments. I think it was the Morrison government a number of years ago. How important is that? I mean, this is a bit of a silly question, but how important is that, and how do we get past this? It's almost a cultural reluctance for us to share. Some may perceive to be evidence of weaknesses in our security settings, for example, for the greater good.
Mm, definitely. Well, I think the first thing to say is if you're not a member of the partner program with ASD, you should be, because that's where you get indicators of compromise, particular technical information. And then for those companies who want to be involved in threat sharing, the cyber threat intelligence sharing platform is really that bi-directional sharing platform that ASD runs. But we recognise, and particularly in the strategy, that there needs to be industry-to-industry sharing, which is why we've got in there, for example, two different elements. One is an ISAC acceleration fund. So ISACs across the world really have focused on industry-to-industry sharing in a sectoral sense. So health ISACs, energy ISACs, all are about information sharing and building capability. And then we have kind of tackled the problem of how do you think about sharing in a different way. So under the coordinator, we've partnered the banks and the telcos, a major retailer, together to say, can we do a little pilot on sharing information that might then inform telcos to try and block some of the phishing scams that are occurring at a volumetric level? So I think it's a mix of different capabilities, a mix of different sharing, and building up that trust over time, both centrally, but also in a kind of a disaggregated way through a federated set of sharing of information. But you're right, it's often a cultural barrier.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that we've got to try and get to in Australia. How do you share for the greater good?
It's interesting, actually, and I know there's you can only go based on survey results to a limited extent, but it kept on coming up time and time again in various sort of multinational surveys that Australia as an organisation was almost the least likely to share relative to even similar highly developed Western economies. So it's, I don't know, there's something cultural sitting below the surface which suggests that that sharing, or at least has prevented that sharing up until this particular point.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting because the value proposition we have in the strategy is we're small in terms of population to enable things like sharing. So we think we've got some unique elements that we can get ahead of the pack. But I've got to say, one cyber incident reported every 6 minutes is a hell of a lot of sharing.
Yeah, very, very cool. I'm going to end our little podcast with one slightly controversial question and one provocative. Hamish, are we losing the cyber war at the moment?
No, I think that cyber is the new volume crime and that it's changing every day. And I see companies stepping up, governments stepping up, and individuals stepping up, and the mix of different initiatives in the strategy, for example. Our hypothesis is that if we did all of those things, actually by 2030, we will be a leader. But I don't think it's going to change the threat environment. So the volume threats are going to come still. It's about how do we get smarter and more secure on an individual level. So the individual who's in primary school needs to be much more cyber secure in the future, right through to the major companies that run the economy.
All right. Here's the provocative one then.
I thought that was it.
It would be remiss of me not to raise the issue of the lawyer and the role of the lawyer in this space. And the reason why I suggest it's provocative because we have seen public statements made by departments within government that lawyers should take a backseat, if you like, in relation to this type of certain parts of incident management. We even see it in the discussion paper itself around the role of the lawyer. And if I'm reading between the lines, it's about the a reticence to share information at certain points in time. Now, I'm a legal advisor, of course, and I'm often that person that gets that 5:45 a.m. call or that late night call. We are working out which way is up. We operate in a way which understands that this is a crisis moving at pace, and legal principles shouldn't be driving the nature of that crisis response. But where is that concern coming from? What's the experience that is driving such a public response in that way? And then finally, in the same vein, what guidance would you give to those of us that are in the room? If you had a chance to sort of speak to us as a community, what guidance would you give to us about how we can improve our game, if I can put it that way? Because as this threat evolves, the legal risks get more and more significant. We see 7, 8 class actions on foot, regulatory actions on foot, litigation on foot. There is a lot at stake well after the incident. You know, the legal tail or the legal risk tail can run for years. Interested in your view.
Well, I think that you can't change the facts. And so despite the fact there are regulatory actions and class actions driving the environment, the worst conversations that I have is with a company and they're reading a legal script that's obviously given to them by a general counsel because it doesn't help resolve the incident, and which is why it kind of gets back to the point about limited use and how do we create that environment that we're actually responding to the incident. The best example, and I used it at Estimates last week with St. Vincent's, is we actually sat down and looked at 4 different scenarios about what would happen, which is showing so much trust to bring government in to say, how do we deal with the worst case scenario? How do we deal with the best case scenario and the two in between? Unfortunately, it was the best case scenario, but that really showed how do you bring government in? How do you collaborate? And ultimately, I think we got a better response by doing that. If we had a barrier where we're very much in a legal frame of mind thinking about the class action that might follow or a regulatory action, then that doesn't resolve the incident. So what we're trying to do is really divorce the two issues. One is, how do we resolve the incident? And then how do you actually think about regulation and class action second? I know that's very simplistic, but that's where I think Australia should be. And frankly, that's why the comments about lawyers are in the paper and being made by public officials.
And I wonder whether or not it has, it's where we are in the life cycle of dealing with these incidents, where we are grappling with, at least at the moment, very, very significant regulatory tails or litigation tails. We're also dealing with decision-making that happens in the first 24, 48 hours. It's very sticky. They're very sticky decisions, but decisions you cannot undo, and the ones that can arise later in the piece. And so maybe it's less about the lawyer and more about the legal framework, resetting and rebalancing the fact that lawyers who are in the room are looking to protect their clients in relation to what is what looks at the moment to be a very, very significant law, legal risk, and balancing that against the practicality of running an effective crisis management process.
For sure.
Hamish, can I thank you for your time today? You continue to be one of the most generous individuals operating in the space out of Canberra. I hope to see you out of Canberra as often as you get a chance. And from our perspective, very grateful. You are the inaugural participant in our podcast series. So it's a podcast series which we hope to bring individuals like you to talk to the legal community and, quite frankly, those that are interested in sort of legal and regulatory matters. So huge thank you from us.
Well, thank you, and thanks for your thought leadership. I know you've got a day job, but you're very generous in thinking about issues and helping us to craft the best policies and legislation and implementation that we can.
Perfect. It's a love fest in the room here.
It certainly is.
Thank you, Hamish. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks again for tuning in to Cross Examining Cyber, a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. In our next episode, we cross-examine Bill Siegel, the CEO of Coveware, the ransomware first responders. This is an incredibly insightful discussion, so please don't forget to tune in. Thank you again, Hamish, and thank you all for listening.